Thank you, Dylan. And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, David B. from Venice Beach.
Hi, I'm David. I'm an alcoholic. And I really want to thank my good friend Lori for inviting me to speak. I've known her for almost 25 years when she got sober. And I am a little nervous. I've never been to this meeting before. There's a lot of people here. It really helps that my wife's sitting in the front row and three really close friends that I've known for a long time got a Facebook messenger from my wife just this afternoon while I was taking a nap. And they showed up at the meeting. And I want to read one paragraph because a lot of times I bring the book with me when I speak and then I get into my favorite subject, me. And this is really apropos for something that just happened. On page 62 and how it works, it says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. That's one of my favorite paragraphs in the book. I'm going to get to it later, but when we walked up here, I was meeting Stephanie and Brian, I believe, right? And I stepped right in front of my wife and started talking about my favorite subject, me, and it was really rude. And so I'm making an amends right now for that. It was wrong, and it was selfish. And my sobriety date's February 8th, 1988. I've been sober for almost 31 and a half years, and I haven't attained perfection yet. I was told a long time ago by an AA couple called Chuck and Lee Cohen. Chuck told me I was all pissed off about something. I think I had wanted a secretary commitment. I was about a year sober, and my best friend won by a couple votes over me, and I was just ranting and raving at coffee. How come I didn't get that secretary position? It should have been for me. And Chuck looks at me and he goes, David, the highest up we get is sober. It's like, wow. But so great to be here. Welcome to the newcomers. Happy birthday to Janet. I love seeing the signer here. There's a lot of meetings in L.A. where I got sober where they have, that. And I think it's a wonderful service, to have. It's beautiful. And congratulations to the 90-day people. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll go anywhere to share for AA. I don't care, because AA has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. It really has. And it hasn't been about money and about property and prestige or rock stardom or any of that stuff. AA has given me a fairly quiet mind some of the time and a peaceful heart. I've taken that ever so long journey from the head to the heart that was so hard to do. Because of AA, I stand before you a fairly peaceful person with some character defects that get in the way sometimes, So my wife and Lori told me don't get lost in the drunkalogue, because don't you love it when somebody has a whole bunch of time and then they share a 45-minute pitch and about 5 minutes before it's over they go, oh, I better get sober. Right? I mean, I believe to follow the book, and what it really says, it's misquoted a lot, but it says what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now. Just a little play on words. Everyone says what it's like, what we were like. And what I was like was a drunk, And it started off for me in Venice Beach. And I also should clarify that I do live right near Palm Desert now. And I guess I'm just like Stephanie, coming here. She didn't want to come. And, man, when my wife said, Daddy, we're moving to the desert, I was like, oh, hell no. Yeah. I do Uber and Lyft driving by day, and sometimes I talk to my riders, right, and they're like, I go, yeah, I moved here from L.A. I used to live in Venice Beach, a couple years ago. And they go, why? And I go, yeah, I just woke up one day and thought I'd go somewhere where it's 115 degrees. You know what I mean? Why not, right? But I do love it there, and we have great AA there. If you're ever in that area, you come to Fellowship Hall over on Portola in Palm Desert, and we have meetings all the time, and it's beautiful. And I've got a men's stag, and I got an AA community out there, and it's fantastic. My wife and I started a meeting pattern after a meeting called the Rush Hour at Marina Center, where Troy and I designed our home group, you know. And anyway, so it started off for me, Venice Beach. It was the late 60s. I was 12 years old. I had been a good kid up to that point in time. I wanted to study. I wanted to be a good kid. I was a smart kid. I liked to play with toys like most kids, you know, set up my little dinosaurs and my little soldiers. And I was 6 years old, and I came in from playing out in the garden, and I looked at my mom, and I said, "Mom, the bugs and the bees are very happy today." You know, I was just this bright-eyed little red-haired kid, you know, who wanted to live life. But the call of the wild was starting to happen. And by the time I got about 12 years old, by now it's about 67, 68, around in there, and it's like, you know, "In a gotta da vida, baby," and, you know, black lights, and the smell of marijuana was in the air, and, you know, Woodstock was not quite there, but Monterey Pop had happened, and, you know, I grew up in Venice, and, you know, all this craziness, like Martin Luther King got assassinated, so there was all this just, you know, the life was swirling, right? And that call was calling to me. And so I remember I met this kid named Buzz, and he was, he had long blonde hair, and he lived down the street from me. And this is really the hippie days, right? I mean, his mom got married on the beach on the Brooks Rocks wearing only seaweed, you know. And, free love, man, like the whole thing, you know. And, you know, I'd walk down the boardwalk, there'd be a guy with a headband, and he'd stand and he'd go, "Pot, acid, speed, pot, acid, speed," and he'd be like, "Yeah, sure, you know, I'd love it, you know what I mean?" Yeah, I didn't know what it was, but, you know, so I was willing to try. And this kid said, Buzz said, "Hey, man, like, do you smoke weed?" And I go, "No, but I want to." And, shortly after that, I smoked a couple joints with these guys underneath a place called POP Pier. And I came out and the world looked different. And I don't know what I was trying to escape at 12 years old, but I just loved the feeling of being high, and I tried to sneak up on the seagulls, you know. I thought I could catch them, you know. Anyway, I went through all the drugs, and I tried to drink a couple times. When I was 13 years old, I drank Red Mountain wine. And and just got super sick, and I said, "Oh, I don't want to do that again," you know. And then when I was 16, I drank a bunch of rum and coke, and I was just like puking over the balcony, and this guy was holding me so I wouldn't fall over the balcony. And like a lot of people, you know how they share, they say, you know, "I drank and I puked and, you know, I took off all my clothes and I couldn't wait to do it again." Not me, you know. It was like I didn't want to do it again. But what happened was is that, you know, I went through all the acid and mini whites, and I did, you know, all the drugs. But by the time I was about 18 or 19, all my friends were getting lives, man. They were getting in bands, and they were getting girlfriends, and I was out of high school. And what I was doing was like sitting in my apartment, like smoking weed and listening to John Coltrane records and wondering why I wasn't in a band, right? Now, I forgot to tell you, I'd started playing guitar when I was like 14 years old, and I practiced real hard, and I was in a little high school band, and I sang a Jethro Tull song at a battle of the bands, and I got a girlfriend when I was 16, and I thought, wow, music's pretty cool, man, you know what I mean? Like, but I wasn't doing anything. I had a Fender Strat with no strings on it sitting in the corner, and I was wondering how come I wasn't in a band, you know? So anyway, I started going down to Venice Beach, and I had a little acoustic guitar, right? And I would go, and I would sit around. They had these little pagodas where everybody would hang out, right? And I'd start playing my acoustic guitar, and people were drinking. And that's how it happened. They handed me the brown bag, and I took the brown bag, and I drank it down. And man, life just got different. I made the smoothest transition from drug addict to alcoholic that one can make, man. I just dropped all those drugs because they weren't working for me, man. They were making me paranoid and making me think. And when I drank, because I think enough, my wife can tell you, I think way too much anyway. He's just even sober, you know. So I was the kind of guy that really needed a drink. So when I found it, it was perfect, you know what I mean? It quieted my mind. And my shirt got a little bit looser, you know, and I kind of like just fit, man. And I was just like, "Hey, baby, can I sing a Bob Dylan song for you?" You know, you know, I got smooth, man. All of a sudden, I was the cat, you know. And things just started happening really fast. By the time I was 21, I got in this band called the Venice Canal Gators. And they used to play on the beach, but they had gigs and clubs too. And the singer was this guy called Hook. And he had one arm, and he wore like kind of a floppy like jean cap, and he was from Weed, California. And he was from California, but he was kind of a redneck, you know what I mean? And he smoked Camel non-filters and drank Budweiser out of the can, and he'd say stuff to me like, "Hey, boy, we're going to work the crowd today," you know what I mean? He'd go, "Oh, the crowd's looking a little thin, David, you know, what's going to happen here," right? And so I lucked into this band. I knew another guy that was playing with him one day. I was walking down. I was calling myself Rock and Roll Dave. I weighed about 145 pounds dripping wet. And just this skinny little 21-year-old kid getting nowhere quick. But I lucked into this band. I happened to meet this guy. And I saw my friend Michael, and he said, "Hey, come over and play." And so I played the rest of the day with these guys on the beach, just busking on the boardwalk with, like, open guitar case, drinking beers, you know, people walking by throwing money in the case. And at the end of the day, they handed me, like, $15 or something. Now, this is, like, 1977, right? I'm like, okay, I got no job. Or maybe I was working as a waiter part-time. I don't know. But, you know, they handed me this money. And Hook looked at me and he said, "Hey, boy, can you be back here tomorrow at 12 noon and play with us?" And I kind of played it off like, yeah, I can do that. And I walked away. I was like, "Oh, God, they like me," you know. And next thing I know, man, I was in a band. I was in the Venice Canal Gators, and they were popular. And then we played the Electric gig. And one day, we were playing on the beach, and Hook goes, "On the flat top guitar, we got Slavin' David." He gave me a nickname. And man, in my mind, like a legend was born, you know what I mean? It was like, you know. And seemed like right around that same time, I met this 5'10½" fine looking brunette. And she became my girlfriend. We ended up moving in together, and I was like, man, I was walking around, and people, I'd go down the boardwalk, and people would say, "Hey, you're Slavin' David. We heard you play the other night." I'd go, "Yeah, man, right on." Like, "Hey, buy me a drink," you know what I mean? And I rode that, man. It was fantastic. I remember one day I'm walking down the boardwalk, and this is before the drum circle. This is when just a bunch of brothers used to hang out in the pagodas and play conga drums, you know? And there was this guy, a poet, called Big Brown. Unfortunately, he got in a fight in 1980 in the Rose parking lot, and somebody ran him over with a car and killed him. He was a sweetheart, that guy. Big old dude. I think they told me he was like a boxer in his former life or something. He was a big old guy. I remember I'm walking down one day. I got my girlfriend, and we're walking on the boardwalk, and he looked at me and goes, "Yo, Red, how'd you get that big old fine girl?" I said, "I'm a guitar player, man." Life was going swell for me. You know what I mean? It was really working out, you know? I like to say I had one really good year as an alcoholic. One really good year. One good one. That was 1977, you know? I fit tight in my Jordache jeans, and I was Slavin' David, don't you know? You know? But it was to change. It was to change. And what happened was one night I went to a party, and I ran out of beer. I was in Hollywood. I wasn't close. I used to really be centrally located. I don't know if anybody will know Venice. You have to kind of know, but we would say that there's no life east of Lincoln Boulevard. That's about a mile off the beach. You know what I mean? Like everything was, I drank in the bars there. I played on the boardwalk. Everything was right here. Well, one night I was out of my comfort zone. I was in Hollywood, and I was at this party, and I drank about a six-pack, and then I couldn't find any more beer. And now this was the other thing I forgot to tell you. When I first started drinking, I knew I'd be okay if I just drank beer. Something told me, just drink beer only, because I guess I could sort of feel that there was an obsessive thing that was happening. When I drank, I had to have more, and, you know, obsession of the mind coupled with an allergy of the body. I didn't know that at the time, but that's what was happening. So this guy goes, "Oh, there's no," I said, "Where's a liquor store? I got to get some more beer." This guy goes, "Oh, there's no liquor stores open, but no problem. I got something for you." And he walked over and he got this big old bottle of Kamchatka vodka down, and he took a can of diet root beer, and I had never drank hard liquor really, right? Except that time I got sick. So he pours this diet this vodka with this diet root beer, and it kind of crackles over the ice, right? And I took this drink, and I slammed it down, and it went. If you've ever heard Clancy speak, he says for an alcoholic, the booze goes down, and it goes down, and it goes boom! You know, it was like that vodka hit me, and I go, this is a revelation, man. You don't get all full and have to keep running to the bathroom when you're drinking beer. You drink this vodka, you get there quick, right? So next thing I know, things just went off the rails. My beautiful girlfriend joined a little organization called the Hare Krishnas. For you younger people with us, they used to always be at the airports, and the girls have a little dot on their head, and they chant, Hare, Hare, Hare Krishna. That's who they are. And so she joined up with them. And then I lost my job as an assistant drug dealer. That was not a good thing for me. And I became basically homeless. I was couch surfing. And right around that time, before all that happened, I had met this guy who knew some like pretty serious rock stars, and they were going to make me a rock star because I had a really good band at the time, and I was starting to get some interest. It was around summer of 1980. I was 24. Things were going pretty good, but it went haywire. The guy that was the rock star was like, you know, drinking like a fish, and then they told me they didn't want me to drink. They said, you know, we're going to pay you a salary, but we don't want you drinking. I said, well, you mean at the gig? Or they go, no, we just don't want you drinking. And I was like, they just basically told me not to drink, and they were going to give me $100 a week if I didn't drink, and I was going to be a rock star. So they gave me the first check, and of course, I was drunk at the bar that same day. And so my, you know, wasn't enough to have the chance to be a rock star. I had to drink. So my rock star career was down the drain. I had all my stuff in a white hefty bag, and I was going from couch to couch. And I'd come over to your house, and I'd say, you know, I'm Slavin' Dave. I'm going to sleep on your couch, drink any booze, snort a little Coke if you have it, and hang out for a little while. You know, you'll dig it. It'd be great. And, after a couple days, they go, hey, Slavin Dave, it's time to hit the road, brother. I'm going to tell this story. It's a little bit inappropriate, but this is Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't pretty. I managed to, you know, grab some girl out of the bar and bring her over to my friend's house one night. I was staying with my friend. He was called Steve Potato, and I bring this girl over there, and, of course, I tell her it's my apartment, you know. This is my crib, you know. And we do whatever we do. I don't much remember. I was in a blackout, but I was sleeping on a cot in the front room, and I had these pillows with, like, feathers, and all I know is there was, like, feathers everywhere. Like, the next morning, there was just feathers all over the place. And my friend, who is his house, comes out and goes, looks at the girl and goes, like, what the hell are you doing in my house? And she goes, well, he said it's his house. That's his house. And he's like, hey, Slavin' Dave, like, hit the frickin' road, bro. Get the hell out of here, right? And so being the selfish, self-centered alcoholic that I am, you know, there's a little vodka left, right? So, you know, it's probably his, but, you know, shit, I need it, man. I'm hungover, you know what I mean? And, you know, the girl goes wherever she goes, and I grab the vodka, and I manage to put a drink together, you know, and he's like, get the fuck out of here, you know? And I got my vodka, and now I got nowhere to live, right? And I got to make a plan again. You know, when you're an alcoholic, you got to make a plan. You got to make it quick. What's going to be my plan? So and of course, I got no car. I got no driver's license. I got nowhere to live. I don't got no money. I don't got no job. I ain't got no job. It's Friday, right? Anyway, so... so, you know, here I am, right? And I'm walking down Venice Boulevard, heading towards the beach, and I remember there's this girl, Linda. She works at a cafe. I'll hit her up. So I go in. I'm like, hey, Linda. We used to work together as waiters. Hey, Linda, can you float me a couple bucks? Can you? You know, this is 1980. If I got $2, I can get started. So she gives me $2, right? So I go to Brandelli's Brig over there on Old West Washington now, foo-foo Abbott Kinney, right? And this was a bar, bucket of blood, sawdust on the floor, opened at 6 a.m., you know, a real alcoholic bar, right? So I get there, it's probably 10 by now, and, you know, I get a plan going. I somehow get a plan going, and I'm staying somewhere else. And this just continues. And I drink my way through everything. My real father died of drug addiction in 1977 when I was 21. My rock star dream is over. I've drank my way through everything. And every feeling I have, I just pour booze on. So every feeling I have, I don't know how to sit. I don't know how to, you know, talk to a friend and say, God, I'm having some feelings, man. My girlfriend left. My rock star career is in shambles. Maybe I need to go to therapy or a meeting or something. No, I went to one meeting in 1980, looked around, saw a bunch of old people there, and, okay, I'm supposed to be out of the drunkalogue. Let's get out of it. Saw a bunch of old people there and felt sorry for them. Meanwhile, I told you where my life was, had all my stuff in a white hefty bag, went to AA, went to the Monday night Venice meeting when it was at the old traffic circle, ended up hearing a guy called Howard Polenz, who just recently passed away, wonderful AA member, beautiful man. Found out later that it was who, I didn't know who he was. And he got up to the podium, he kind of talked funny like this, and he said, you know, I used to drink Old Crow at 6 o'clock in the morning and lose control of my bowel movements. And I'm 24 years old, right? And I look around, I said, man, these poor old SOBs need this AA thing. And they gave me the book, and they said, oh, keep coming back and stay sober. And I was like, yeah, right, great. And I just drank and drank and drank and drank. And finally, I started coughing up blood towards the end of 1987. And I knew I was in trouble. And I started having these little conversations in my mind, little conversations that went something like this. You're going to die pretty soon. What's your mom going to think? It's going to be really sad. And then my ego kicked in. I started thinking about people talking about me because I was a local celebrity in Venice. I was kind of like the guitar star down on the boardwalk. Everybody knew me. I called myself the king of the boardwalk. I had a huge ego with inferiority complex of alcoholics, right? And, you know, I'm a total piece of crap, but I'm the biggest one, don't you know, right? And, I'd have these little thoughts in my head of that someone's going to go, hey, remember that Slave and David guy used to play Chuck Berry songs on the boardwalk? Yeah, he died the other day. Ah, it's too bad. Let's go get a drink, you know? I'd be an addendum to somebody's conversation. So what finally happened was I went to my family doctor right around that time. My family doctor said to me, David, you have the beginnings of liver damage, high blood pressure. How much do you drink? And I said, well, I drink on the weekends, which I did. Somehow I was able to pretty much stay dry through the week, but then Friday would come and it was the caged animals out and boom, here we go. So I kept trying to quit, and I remember the last Super Bowl, I went to my friend's house. It was the one where Doug Williams threw the 6 touchdown passes at the beginning of 88. And I remember I watched the Super Bowl and I was stumbling home and I just thought, you're going to die pretty soon, man. It's over. And finally, I woke up on February 7th, 88, and I was drinking wine coolers in the morning because I'd get up in the morning with my hands shaking like this, and I needed a drink, you know, and I had to get it with two hands sometimes because I couldn't hold it. And I would hope that I could get the drink down and then not get sick, or if I'd get sick and then puke and then get the drink down, and I had the chemical smell of the booze that's sweating back through your pores, and you can't wash it off. And I was not a vision for you. It was not a pretty sight. I looked like a big red freaking tomato, you know, and it was just horrible. And so I called my mom. You know, what do Venice legend wannabe rock stars, you know, do when they hit bottom? They call mommy. And I called my mom in little Northern California, and I said, Mom, I'm a hopeless drunk, and I'm probably going to die. Sorry to have let you down. She said, David, although it breaks my heart, if that's the road you choose to take, I have to set you free to go do that. Where do you think she'd been? Al-Anon, absolutely, brother. Absolutely. What a great answer that Mom gave me. Because I hung up the phone and a little voice said, maybe you could try not drinking. And I went out and got as drunk as I could that day. And I was toasting everybody. About a month and a half ago, I went to the Dodger game with a guy who saw me on that last day drinking and was there when I finally made it to my first meeting. Been friends with him ever since, Barry. Unbelievable. So anyway, I went out and I got as drunk as I could, and the next day I got up and I had called in sick. I had a little job as a painter's helper. I barely had a little apartment on Paloma Avenue in Venice that I was holding on by a thread. There was homeless people all over. The whole homeless movement was starting, and I knew I was going to be with those people any minute. And that day I got up, and the first thing my head said was, have a drink and you can start this sober thing tomorrow. And something happened.
And I knew I couldn't take that drink, and that's my sobriety date, February 8th, 88. I've been sober since that day. Something happened. I didn't even get to a meeting until I was almost 30 days sober. And I'll tell you what, man, I was dry. I was brush fire dry, man. It was bad. And I was just walking around. I was still playing my guitar on the beach, and I'd be out there trying to sing, you know, Johnny Be Good, and I felt like bugs were crawling in my shorts, and I was like, go, Johnny, go, go. And I was like, you know, I wanted to run, right? And I was like, oh, well, you better go, right? And I was like, ah! You know, and I was like, you know, everybody's looking at me. Yeah, well, you're playing music in front of on the street. Of course they're looking at you, you know. And now instead of beers all around my guitar case, I had, like, Perrier bottles and stuff, right? All these, like, club sodas and everything and Cokes. And people knew me. See, for years, people were trying to get me in AA. I was, like, such a public drunk. I was, like, sort of like the town drunk, you know what I mean? The guitar player drunk that everybody knew. And people would ride up, and I'd be all drunk on the beach. They'd go, hey, Slave and Dave, we're holding a chair for you in AA. I'd go, chair, you know, right? That's your chair, right? And, so anyway, these people would say, hey, man, are you going to some meetings? You're not drinking. I go, oh, I was counting days. I don't know why. I'd say, hey, I haven't had a drink in like 14 days, but you going to a meeting? No. I remember this guy once, he said, hey, there's a really cool CA meeting on Thursday night at a boat here in Marina Del Rey you could go to, right? And I said, no, Thursday nights I watch Bill Cosby and Hill Street Blues, man. You know, I was very busy, you know, NBC night, you know what I mean? Had to watch that stuff, you know. Had to see Cheers, right? So, finally, I went to go see my bass player friend, Billy Rizzi, who used to play with me on the beach. I used to go raid his liquor cabinet in the mornings before we'd play, and he wasn't home, and I saw this guy, Little Joey, who ran the West Side Alano Club. Gunfighter Joey, right? Little Joey. And Joey was smoking a cigarette on his balcony, and I said, Joey, that's the guy, because he had taken me to that meeting where I heard Howard Poland's, right? So I go, Joey, that's the guy, and I run over to his house, and I get up there, and I'm like nuts, right? I haven't had a drink in like 25 days, and I'm talking like this, hey, Joey, I haven't had a drink, and I, and you know, I don't know, I haven't gone to a meeting, but, right? And just like spinning, you know, the total newcomer spin, right? Out of your mind, just bouncing off the wall, still shaking, all red, I haven't had a drink, you know, and finally takes a drag off his cigarette, he goes, I'm speaking in a meeting Saturday night. Maybe you'd like to go. And this was a Thursday. He was so smart. If he would have told me there was a meeting, I would have had to go do my laundry or something. He said, we're going now. And I, no, well, I'll catch you next time, you know. I went home, and I was living with this crackhead alcoholic guy named James, who was a guitar player. And I said, hey, man, I'm going to go to AA Saturday. And I goes, good for you. I've been a few times. Good for you. Good luck with that. And James is now a touring blues musician and doing fantastic. And we're cool. We're all cool now, you know. So great. So I went to that first meeting, and I walked in, and I was coming up. I was 27 days dry. It was a Saturday night at Venice High School where I had failed to graduate. I had my leather cap just stuck on my head and cocked it, and I was just sweating. And I walked in, and there was this guy, a different Howard, not Howard Pullins. He was a guy, Howard, with like a red beard. I think he might have died of AIDS years ago, but he was such a nice man. I remember he was at all the meetings, and I walked up in that first meeting, and Howard was greeting at the door, and I walked up, and he said, and he put his hand out, and he said, stick with us, stick with the winners. I've never forgotten that, because I've been able to do it since then. I've been able to stick with you guys a day at a time, and it has not been a cakewalk, and it hasn't been always beautiful and roses and a bowl of cherries, and it's just been fabulous, but it's all been worth it. It's all been worth it. All the pain, all the crap, whatever I had to go through to get to where I am today is all worth it, because I do have a beautiful life, and I continue to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, and like you said, sponsor people. I have my sponsor, Israel, who still lives in L.A., I tried to get actually a sponsor out in the desert, and I realized, like, what am I doing? Israel's my sponsor. I don't need a sponsor. I'm a long time sober. I don't need a face-to-face. I can talk to other alcoholics. I need a sponsor who knows my stuff, so when the crap does hit the fan, I pick up the phone, and I'll call Israel, and we say the third step prayer, and he'll say, okay, you got an inventory? Read it to me, and I'll do a 10th step, you know, a written 10th step. Tonight, I did a verbal 10th step. That keeps me current, right? So I got a couple stories that I want to tell that Lori asked me to tell. She's heard me a bunch of times, and... So anyway, you know, I started going to meetings, and you know, I just did the typical newcomer stuff. Like you said, I wanted to share at every meeting. And I think it's, I actually love it when people with 3 weeks share. I can learn really good, cool stuff when people with 3 weeks. I think it's great. I don't believe in that keep the cat in your ears, put it in your mouth. If I was told to sit down and shut up when I got here, I would have been horrible. I didn't need to be beat up. I'd already done it myself really good. I needed somebody to put their arm around my shoulder and say, you know what, Dave, we're so glad you're here. People like Manny and Rita, who welcomed me as a newcomer. You know, they're sitting here tonight. They were here when I got there in Santa Monica. He said, it's okay. And then Manny, he took me on a panel, right? And I was only like a couple years sober. And then I went on a panel at Claire Detox in Santa Monica. And Manny was sitting in there. He'd gotten drunk. I was like, what? He says, the look on my face was priceless, right? I thought he was some kind of, he had 5 years. I thought he was some kind of AA guru or something. You know what I mean? Here he was at Claire Detox, like, what? But he's sober for 29 years now. He's been back since then, you know? So, you know, this is a beautiful thing, you know? Not everybody gets it the first time out. We don't shoot our wounded here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? So I just did the deal, and I got my year, and, you know, I changed sponsors. Joey was my first sponsor, and then I got this guy, Israel, and what happened was Israel really just got me deeper into the book and into the steps, and what started to really change for me was in my second year, I did a four-step out of the big book. The first time I did it was just this long questionnaire thing, and it was really good, and I had some secrets, but in my second year, I did a big book inventory. I wrote my resentments and the cause, and what happened was what revolutionized my life and my program to this day is that I wrote my part in all these resentments. Like the book says, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate seemingly without provocation, but we have made decisions based on self which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So I resented this guy, Sid, who was like my best friend since we were 16, and we played in bands together, and he was like the guy that we'd like sit up late at night with some outside issues along with our alcohol and go, bro, I love you. We're going to be rock stars together. It's you and me against the world, bro. I love you. If things don't work out with girls, maybe we'll just be together, bro. It'll be fine, you know. It'll be all right, bro. It'll be fine, you know. That kind of friend, right? And it went sour, and I tried to make amends to him, but it didn't work out. But what happened was when I wrote that inventory, you know, I resent Sid. I mean, I flew a girl down to go to the Rolling Stones concert in 1978, and he snagged her from me, you know. So I had some serious resentments about this guy. You know, he attacked me on a gig, you know. And so, you know, I resent Sid, but what the cause? What was my part? I was drunk at every rehearsal. I told club owners to screw off. I sabotaged every chance. I was selfish. I didn't want to do anyone else's songs, only me. It's my band. We do it my way. You know, selfishness, right? And I was able to make amends to him through help of my wife helped me with that one, and it was fantastic, right? So I want to tell this story. So when I was a couple of years sober, I got back in the restaurant business. I had been in the restaurant business all during my like teenage years when I was in high school, and then I'd worked as a waiter for a while when I was early 20s. I got sober. I was working as a parking attendant. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. Rockstar career hadn't really worked out. I'm like 32, almost 32. I get sober, and I wake up, and like, now what, right? So, you know, I go and I get this little job at a place called Tiny Nailers in Marina Del Rey, and I'm working, and I'm the angriest waiter ever at this point in time, right? You know, I'm like, we got no soup spoons, and I'm banging around, and, you know, people next door from, like, Daniel Freeman came in. I mean, Chris Farley walked in there one day when he was in treatment, you know. People like that, and I'd be running around, and they'd go, who's that waiter? They go, oh, that's Slavin' Dave. He's an AA. He's fine, you know. Great example, right? You know? Shit, I don't want what he has, right? So, how am I doing on time? Oh, getting there. So, anyway, so one day it's like a slow Saturday in the afternoon. I'm like the only waiter on, and I just, you know, a couple years sober, about two and a half maybe, and this guy walks in, and he had like cerebral palsy or something, and he was having trouble in the restaurant, like getting in, like he kind of fell down, and the busboy like picked him up, and got him in the chair, and of course he sat, thank you. He sat in my station, and which I was the only waiter, and he looked up at me with this big smile, and he said, can I have a chocolate ice cream? And I said, of course. And I started to walk away to go get him the chocolate ice cream. And he said, you know, I only have a dollar on me. Is that going to be enough? And I said, yeah, I'll cover the rest. You know, I bought it for him, my waiter tips. And as I started to walk away to go get him the ice cream, I nearly broke into 1,000 pieces. Because what happened was is that I realized that I really cared about that guy that I had just met that moment. That I didn't want him to be having a bad day. I didn't want him to fall out of his chair. I wanted him to get his chocolate ice cream and have an okay day. That's impossible for me. I don't care when I'm an alcoholic. I don't care. I don't care about you. I don't care about your feelings. I don't have empathy. I'm drunk. I want what I want. What can you do for me? When my girlfriend joined the Hare Krishnas, I didn't care so much that she was confused. It's I don't have a girlfriend anymore. How can you not leave? How can you leave? It's about me, right? God damn it. How dare you? You don't leave me. I'm Slavin David. You know? So, you know, and the change, when they talk about a psychic change, you know, I started to get more in touch with my higher power. I really struggle with that. You know, at one point, I remember I was all pissed off at work when I was a parking attendant. And my buddy Kevin said, you know, Slavin, Dave, you need to pray or something, bro. You're having a really bad day. And you know how another alcoholic will pull your covers just at the right time? And I started to get all defensive, like, how dare you? And I got up to about here, like, what do you mean? And I kind of got up to about here, and I went, oh, he's right. And I said, okay, Kevin. And I went up to the bathroom stall, and I hit my knees, and I said the first part of the third step prayer that I could remember from the meetings. And the beginning of the surrender started to happen, of the second surrender of not just the alcoholism, but that God's will, that I could, you know, be in acceptance. So I kind of ran out of time for a lot of the stuff that I wanted to say, but so I went through some difficult times, like in my fifth year of sobriety, where, you know, I went sought some outside help. I got really angry. I fired Israel as my sponsor. I went all over the place. And when I was about 7.5 years sober, I completely had an emotional breakdown at the podium at 26 and Broadway in Santa Monica. I was the main speaker on a Saturday night, and I was talking, and towards the end of my pitch, I completely lost it. And I said, I'm tired of going home alone with my black cat. Where the F is mine? You know, when am I going to get my relationship? When is my, you know, what about me? And I just started sobbing at the podium. And we all went to coffee, and this one lady, I forget her name, she had gone out. She looked at me and she goes, that was really good that you shared all that stuff. She goes, I went out and got loaded when that happened for me, when I hit that point. She goes, you got a sponsor? And I went, no. I was sponsoring myself, and we all know what that leads to, right? You got an asshole for a sponsor, right? And so, ism, I sponsor myself, Mickey Bush. Anyway, I had thought about getting a female sponsor. Now, I was 7.5 years sober, so I was doing it for the right reasons. I didn't have an ulterior motive. No, seriously, I did not have an ulterior motive. I could not get in a relationship. I had at that point in time been in one relationship with a drinking alcoholic, which is like a disaster when you're sober. Like, you go share at a panel at Claire Detox and then go sleep with a drunk girl. It's just not, you know, something's wrong with that picture. But, hey, I was a musician. I went to a gig. Who are you going to meet, right? I wasn't hooking up with AA girls, so it just wasn't working out for me. Anyway, Susan so helped me. And what happened was is that when I was in my 11th year of sobriety, I had had one more relationship with another drinking alcoholic who broke up with me because I just said I didn't want to be in a room where all she was smoking pot. She took real big offense with that. And I was threatening her usage, you know what I mean? And so, you know. So anyway, but, you know, I didn't take that one as hard, and I thought, you know, maybe I could have a girlfriend. And about a month and a half later, I went to this meeting at the Marina Center on a Tuesday night, and I was sitting there, and the speaker was talking about father-son issues, and I was really just going through that whole thing about my dad and my stepdad and my relationship with them. And 5 minutes? Cool. And so anyway, After the meeting, this lady named Candace came over to me that I knew in AA, and she gave me a hug, and she goes, I don't know if this is the right time, but she goes, there's somebody that wants to meet you. And in my mind, I thought, oh, great, another newcomer to sponsor, because I've always sponsored people. I've always been active in that. And then she said, and she's signing court cards at the podium. And I went, she? Ooh. Got all excited, you know what I mean? I was like, oh, yeah. And I looked, and there was this cute little red-haired girl with a Hawaiian shirt on was signing court cards at the podium. She was talking to everybody all, yeah, and I'm waiting my turn. And I finally walk up, and I go, yeah, you're Vicky, huh? And she goes, yeah. I go, you got about 3 years, right? And she goes, yeah. She goes, you got about 10. Well, it turns out she was at my 10-year party that I had thrown for myself, and I was all obsessed with some chick named Rhoda who wouldn't give me the time of day. And so I didn't really see Vicky there, but I found out later she was kind of stalking me. She liked me. And I kept showing up at all these events. A guy unfortunately passed away from cancer, and I was singing a song at his memorial, and there I was, right? So I said, hey, would you like to go to coffee? And she's like, well, no, I can't go tonight. And I go, well, no, not tonight. I just mean sometime, you know? And so she gave me her card, and... Now, guys, you got to play it cool, right? So, like, don't call right away, you know what I mean? Because you don't want to seem desperate, you know, because let me just tell you guys, in case you don't know, chicks smell desperation. They sniff it out. They know. Okay. So, you know, be that kind of aloof guy that's cool, you know what I mean? They like that. Anyway, so I waited a couple days, and... I called, and we talked for about 2 hours on the phone the first night, and we went on a little coffee date, and we haven't been apart since. It's been over 20 years, and we have kids and grandkids. My 19-year-old is in college in San Francisco. She's in L.A. on break. I'm going to see her in another couple weeks when I go for another Dodger game with my brother-in-law and go see my granddaughter. And what? I'm getting to it. I saw this little girl come out of the chute, and when they cleaned her up and they brought her over to the table, I was the first one that walked over, and I looked at her and I said, "Welcome to the world, Haley." And I just lost it, man. Just lost it, you know. Just an incredible moment. And now our younger daughter Marissa is pregnant with her first kid, who's going to be born around sometime in November, and it's a boy. Joaquin Bowie is he's going to be his name. And just incredible, you know, the things that have happened. I would have never thought, like I said, I wanted to move out to the desert, but life stuff happened. And when I was getting ready to move out to the desert, you know, I'd been 28 or so years sober in AA. I knew everybody, and that was my fear. It was kind of my ego. You know, everybody knows you in AA. You speak at all these meetings, Slave and David. Hey, Dave, you sponsor everybody. You're bup, bup, bup. And I go out to the desert. I'm some bald guy sitting in the corner with 28 years, like a newcomer, but with a whole bunch of time. Nobody freaking knows me, right? You know, it's like, oh, my God. And it was horrible. You know, it was like... I remember we were first there, I didn't have a job or anything, my wife didn't have a job, I'm in my pajamas, it's hot as shit, and she goes, Daddy, you know, Dr. Phil's on, you know, and I'm like, great, you know, here I am in the desert watching Dr. Phil and going to Walmart, you know what I mean, like, wow, I was supposed to be a rock star, man, what the frick happened, you know what I mean, like, this is a bad deal, you know. But I got into action, you know, and, you know, I played at the 19th hole last night with my band full of, like, sober guys. We're in a rock and roll cover band. It took me about a year, but I got into a band. I love the people I play with. I do it for the sheer fun of it. My wife told me to not say that I don't care if I'm a rock star anymore because, you know what, even at 63, I'm not going to totally give up the dream. I would say it'd be highly unlikely, but shit. If you want to give me a record deal, if that thing still exists, I'll sign it, okay? I'll still go. I'll quit that Uber shit in a minute. All right, I got to end you up with one real quick story. So in 2009, around when you got sober, at the end, the last day of the year, we were up in Northern California visiting my mom when she's still alive. She passed a few years ago. left me the money that we can own a home in the desert. Anyway, I got a call to play a gig, and it was by the Santa Monica Pier, and it was for the Ohio State football team pep rally for the Rose Bowl game, and there was 30,000 people there. So I got to have my rock star moment in 2009. And what happened was we got hired for the gig. We got paid real good money. I put the band, you know, got the band ready real quick. We went to do it, and the lady that was running the gig, she said, look, this is what I want you to do. You go up to the mic, and you say this. You walk up to the mic, and you say, O-H, right? And so, is anybody from Ohio here? What do you say back to me?
Ohio!
Yeah! Ohio! So I had 30,000 people scream that back to me, all a sea of red, right? Archie Griffin was there, saw us play, said he really liked our band. And it was just phenomenal, you know, just the rush of that gig, and people still talk about it. I remember that day you played there. And then at the end of the gig, I came back home to our house, and I got home, and I told my wife we played in front of all these people. She said, that's great. Go pick up the dog shit in the yard there. Thanks.